Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. After almost 4 years of conflict in Ukraine, some European leaders are beginning to realize a dialogue with Russia might be a good idea. Better late than never, I suppose. The question is, what can the Europeans say at this point? Crosstalking the Ukraine conflict, I'm joined by my guest, James Jatris in Virginia. He is a former U.S. diplomat and former advisor to U.S. Senate Republican leadership. In London, we have Adeyinka Makende. He is an independent academic. And in Reston, we have Michael Maloof. He is a former Pentagon senior security policy analyst. All right, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with Michael. Michael, you know, we keep hearing these words, productive and constructive. And I'm not really sure what that means, because when the Russians are saying it and the Americans are saying it, I begin to question what that means. Is it just mean that there's a dialogue continuing and they don't want to have high expectations? Neither side wants to be blamed for a breakdown in talk. So constructive and productive works for me, I guess. Go ahead.
Well, thanks for having me on. I think that it's diplo speak that means nothing's really going on, but conversations are continuing. Look, Trump goes along with the last person he spoke to, whether it's the Russian side or the Ukrainian side, and we always hear these glowing reports of that everything is on track. But the question really remains. It gets right down to the nitty gritty. When do you get the Ukrainians and the Russians together to start talking? And that's just not happening. And it's complicated by the fact that you have the Europeans who want to do nothing but continue the war. And they've made that very clear. They've got this thing against Russia that goes back hundreds of years. And it's really gotten to be ridiculous. And they've just, this insanity has got to stop. And I think Trump recognizes this. But I also think it's a prelude to the beginning of the end of NATO, because Trump is really not listening to the Europeans. So I think when you talk about productive, I think it means ultimately Trump understands the Russian position of security. He is big on security. He understands it. He understands spheres of influence. And I think that this is where, but he can also distinguish where the Europeans are coming from. And they are broke. They cannot afford to continue this conflict. And I think that he recognizes that, but he's also leaving it up ultimately to Zelensky, to Russia, to solve this problem, because it's their problem and it's not ours, the U.S. problem. And if the Ukrainians ultimately want to follow the course of the Europeans, then as far as he's concerned, Russia will continue on doing what it's been doing.
I think, Jim, that's what's really happened here. We saw a few days ago the failed attempt on the part of the Europeans to steal Russian sovereign assets. They failed on that. So they went to the ridiculous plan of a 90 billion euro lifeline to Ukraine. This may play into Trump's hands, because the Ukrainians have institutionalized the Ukraine problem for them. So what happens when the 90 billion runs out? Another 90 billion, and then another 90 billion. I mean, so it's your problem. You want to pay for it? It's broken. You want to pay for it? It's all yours. I find it really astounding that the Europeans would go down this path, because now they're stuck with it.
Well, you know, the money doesn't instantly translate into men and military equipment. I mean, you can sustain the regime in Kiev with money, but that's not do you much good at the front. My perspective is a little bit different from Mike's. I don't think there's that much difference between Washington and the Europeans. I mean, they're playing good cop, bad cop here. Marco Rubio has admitted that this is a proxy war by the United States against Russia. Trump has sent his New York flim-flam men over there to negotiate, at least appear to be negotiating on the issues of interest to the Russians, but they keep coming back to center, which is to find some way to package a ceasefire, put enough lipstick on that pig and tempt the Russians to kiss it, which I don't think they're inclined to do. So they'll keep going through the motions here. And the Russians, for their part, they're willing to play polite. They realize there are differences between the Americans and the Europeans. And obviously, Kiev I don't think a negotiation between Kiev and Moscow really matters. It really is Americans and the Russians. And the Russians are willing to play that game. Okay, fine. We'll listen politely. We'll listen to what Witkoff and Kushner have to say. But they realize they're never going to offer what the Russian minimal demands are in this conflict. And even if they did, by some miracle, the West never keeps its agreements. There will never be an agreement that the Russians can sign that they can be confident the West would actually implement. So I think, you know, this is going to continue on like this for some time. We'll keep going back and forth. Oh, we almost got an agreement. No, we don't have an agreement. We almost have an agreement. No, we don't have an agreement. And, you know, how many times do we have to see this movie, Peter?
No, I agree. I mean, I've been saying just about ever since the Istanbul process, I've been saying this is going to be decided on the battlefield. Okay. What we have to avoid is a miscalculation, a false flag. That's what we have to worry about, because there's not going to be, in a conventional sense, a negotiated end of this conflict. It'll be a fait accompli. Let's go to London. You know, the Emmanuel Macron, I don't know, he's not a serious person, so I don't know if I need to take his word seriously. But, you know, he's put in the offing of, maybe we should have a dialogue with the Russians and with the Russian leader, Vladimir Putin. Now, he said that on Friday. I don't know what he thinks today, okay? But so if the Europeans, and they should have from the get-go, started talking to the Russians, what could they possibly say at this point?
Well, at the moment, it appears to be nothing, simply because Europe is at least putting on the effort of showing that it is on a war footing. Military leaders, the chief of defense staff in London told a conference that sacrifices are going to have to be made in the future, speaking about generations and that sort of thing. Germany has has played the path forward to make conscription mandatory. So far, it's going to be voluntary, but it will then be made mandatory depending on the take-up. Late April 2024, the Polish chief of general staff of the armed forces said that Europe would be involved in a war, and that most of the professional soldiers are not going to last through that war, and it's going to be up to the conscripts to finish it off. So that's not the language of diplomacy. It's the language of intransigence. It's the language of delusion. So Macron blows hot and cold, and I would obviously judge things by the European actions, which are not positive.
Yeah, well, I mean, but actions speak far, far more powerful than words. They tried to steal Russian assets, and now they're mugging their own taxpayers. So this is the caliber of people here. Mike, what we just heard, you know, we have to have conscription, we have to sacrifice the next generation. I mean, why can't you flip it on its head and say, we desperately need negotiations and diplomacy so the next generation doesn't have to fight? What is so hard about doing that? Why are they so, the word intransience has been mentioned here. What is at stake here? I mean, before February 2022, Ukraine didn't play any role whatsoever in European security.
I think what you're seeing here is a major division in the principal NATO countries of Germany, France, England, in which the elite leadership differs from what the population itself wants. The population is suffering. For the elites, the leadership, especially in the UK, this is their hook. Ukraine is their hook to have a constant antagonism with their arch foe that goes back centuries that I referred to earlier, and that is Russia. Russia and UK have historically been at odds with each other. They have always competed for empire, but England today has got to realize it has no more empire, it has no more massive fleet, and it's no bigger than the state of Indiana. So, you know, get over it, move on, and listen to your people. The people don't want war, whether it's Germany, France, or England, and certainly the rest of Europe. They can't afford it. and their quality of life is suffering greatly. Their economies are shot all to hell, and they're suffering from and they can't, and if they have notions of trying to rebuild their industries to a war production, they cannot afford it. And already they're talking about going into tremendous debt to continue the conflict with Russia. And that alludes to your earlier point about, well, where did the funds come from after that? Europe is going to break itself. They are suicidal by nature, and they just cannot get over it.
I don't understand. You know, maybe I'm missing something here, but for us on this program, it's been obvious from the get-go that the Ukraine project has been a huge grift, and it's enriched Zelensky and his circle. I mean, on an unbelievable scale, and this is common knowledge. Maybe just the tip of the iceberg, but the European Union wants to, you know, it's going to give it a sweetheart loan that it doesn't have to pay back, and a lot of it's in cash. I mean, this is the ultimate slippery slope scenario. I don't understand the rationality. They're going to break their own bank for a clique in Kiev?
Well, I think you put your finger on it when you said the word grift, because these people are grifters. And let's keep in mind, they're not just grifters who are themselves profiting in various ways from maintaining this war, but also the fact that these are people who are alienated from their own population. You know, a lot of people express this kind of confusion. Don't they realize the Ukrainians can't win? Why don't they come to the table? Why don't they see reality? I think they see reality just fine. What they see is they've got a good thing going for themselves, and they also have this Manichaean mindset that the Russians represent absolute evil. You know, it's democracy versus autocracy. You cannot compromise with absolute evil. So they've got this mentality they simply can't drop. And we have to add to that, they hate their own people, their own traditions, their own culture, their own nation. That's why you see them, you know, importing, you know, hordes of migrants from abroad, why, you know, they're shutting down free speech within their own countries because they can't tolerate dissent, all in the name of democracy. So, you know, to give him credit, Trump and the new national security strategy did blast these people because, in fact, they are destroying their own countries. But I don't know where that leads you eventually. I mean, you know, first off, I don't think these political systems in these countries are flexible enough for more rational leadership, more representative populist leadership to come to power, as we've seen in places like Hungary and Slovakia. I don't know how that can happen in Germany or France or in Britain. I think
they destroy their countries. We have the Romania precedent that you'll cancel results. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to our guest in London. What do you make of this Witkoff-Dmitriev duo? Because it's really quite interesting. The Russians are mirror what Trump is doing. Dmitriev doesn't have really an official position in all of this. He's an envoy of the president of the Russian Federation. And then we have Witkoff. And there's a very interesting symmetry there because neither one of these guys have the power to sign a document, okay? Their bosses want them to talk and communicate. But it's a very interesting dynamic, because it's not Marco Rubio, and we know that Marco Rubio is a snake in the grass. I wouldn't trust him as far as I could throw him, even though he's a small guy. But, you know, there's a very interesting symmetry. Even Dmitriev's tweets are very, you know, reflective of kind of an American tone, which, you know, living here in Russia for so long, public officials don't talk that way. But Dmitriev is mimicking what he hears from American envoys, as it were. What's your thoughts on that in London?
Well, I think perhaps, I mean, in the first place, you can't have somebody like Sergei Lavrov speak to a New York real estate dealer. That is not statecraft. Then in the other instance, I think perhaps the Russians are looking a little bit forward. to break in the thaw, regardless of the situation on the ground in Europe, in terms of economic cooperation with the Americans. This could be to do with a number of areas, including the Arctic, cooperation over the Arctic. And so it's a merger of the sort of the merchant classes. I think they're trying to, in Russia, they're trying to get the tone of things about Trump, see what they can get out of him. But they are quite aware, I believe, of the underlying trend of things. That national security strategy document is just simply the Wolfowitz doctrine repurposed. The aim is still to weaken Russia and to get it to surrender its sovereignty. That is the ultimate aim. All they're doing is this division of labor, which I think Rubio, who's somebody, when comparing him with Lavrov, said it was like, Bozo the Clown, and Socrates or something along those lines. They will eventually still be aiming for Russia's destruction. So I think the Russians are looking forward to sort of breaking thaws in terms of economic relations with the Americans, but also seeing that they will complete things in the battlefield. And I will just make one more point. I think certainly the United States and Europe are destroying themselves. This is multifaceted on many levels. And one big instance of that is the issue of resource theft. What this war against Russia is, using Ukraine as a proxy, is an attempt at resource theft. They want to control Russia's resources as they did at the time of the Yeltsin era. And Europe has given America that kind of cover. America at the moment is implementing the repurposing the Monroe Doctrine, turned the United States Navy into a Leviathan monster involved in acts of piracy. And again, that is a move towards resource theft. So I would say that that needs to be kept in line in the conversation. There are many issues that one could point to in terms of both the United States and Europe destroying themselves. But America is controlling Europe. That is for sure. It's become demilitarized. It's also economically weak after COVID, all that quantitative easing. It's saddled with debt. It's got no chance in a fight.
That's another form of resource grabbing is debt, because they're indebting their own population. It's really interesting. It's how the colonial project is actually within the empire, and they're picking apart at the carcass here. Jim, people talk about this war of attrition in Ukraine. I completely disagree with it. The Russians want to destroy the Ukrainian military, and they let the military come to them, okay? And they're not in a big hurry, okay? And there are a lot of people that are not happy about that. I would like to see this conflict come to an end, too. But, I mean, as we've heard from all of you, I've heard from all of you here, this is a conflict of attrition, and the West is losing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where what was just said earlier from London, that what we're seeing is the West is devouring its own carcass. In other words, that having found itself in this situation, it's cannibalizing itself and making its situation even worse. And I don't see any way that they can get out of this. But this is where we really have to start to worry about what they do in desperation. And this is where I think the Russians do have to walk a tightrope. On the one hand, the longer they draw this out, the more desperate these people will become, and the more they may do something really stupid, like try to introduce some troops into Ukrainian territory still controlled by Kiev, or some kind of a provocation like a dirty bomb or something like that. I don't know what they've got up their sleeve.
What they have up their sleeve right now is this so-called shadow fleet. This is they were looking for a provocation. Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. If you're going to have piracy in the Caribbean, why can't you have piracy in the Black Sea, okay? And, it's a tripping point here. Michael, this is the thing, and I also think about maybe an incident around the Zaporozhye nuclear plant, because what they want to do is scare people. They want to scare people, okay? And there's nothing like a Chernobyl-like incident. I live here. I'm scared of it, okay? Go ahead.
Well,
you're right. Yeah, Peter. I mean,
go ahead, jump in.
Peter, that if they do speed this up, that could also cause a panic reaction in the West, and that's where the Russians really do have to be careful. I would incline toward what you said, Peter, that finishing this sooner rather than later, knowing there cannot be a genuine agreement with the West, I think is actually the smarter way to go. And again, you know, the Russians have to play their cards carefully here. Sorry, Michael.
No, that's fine. I think too that that Russia is going to continue this conflict, no matter what. The Europeans are desperate. They will try scare tactics. I would also point out one other thing. I think what Trump is trying to engage with Russia is a renewal of the old concept of spheres of influence. Again, yeah. I'm beginning to get that sense. Trump's focus is more in the Caribbean, in the hemisphere area, Greenland. I mean, once again, he just brought up the whole Greenland thing. This thing with Ukraine, he sees it as Europe's problem. He doesn't see it as the U.S. problem, and he doesn't want, and he wants to make nice with Russia on in a variety of other strategic areas.
Yeah, I mean, let's go back to London
here.
I want to make sure everybody gets the same amount of time. I know. I know why you disagree. I know why. Okay. And I think I'm going to try. I'm going to find a way to thread the needle right now with our guest in London. Trump is interested in assets. That's why he's interested in the Arabs in the Gulf. Okay. He wants to make money here. Okay. He sees Venezuela as a gateway to taking down Nicaragua, Colombia, Cuba. And that has nothing to do with politics. It has about resource control. Okay. And I think that's why he likes being around people like Witkoff, because they talk about real deals. Geopolitics and financial dealing sometimes have an overlap, but generally not. What are your thoughts? Go ahead, in London.
Yeah, I think if we say Trump is from the merchant class, it's not necessarily a good thing to be a leader in a political sense. This transactional deals, they don't really last that long. They're not embedded in the way in which statecraft has been developed, and so it's going to be good petrol for Trump for the moment, but a very poor engine in the long run. I think it is still nonetheless. I don't agree with the idea that it is a somewhat spheres of influence issue. It's as it was mentioned back in February. It's a division of labor. Trump just wants to lift a lot of the burden over to the Europeans.
Okay, Michael, go ahead, jump in.
Yeah, I would add that the fact that you have Witkoff and Dmitriev, both with economic backgrounds, with real life economic intentions, I think that Russia and the United States see a greater geostrategic interest in trying to work out greater deals economically, and this is where Trump is. He wants to move on. I think the Ukrainian
I know Jim disagrees. We're almost out of time. Jim, disagree. Go ahead.
Sure. Very quickly, Trump is venal and transactional. The Russians understand that, so they're willing to talk that game, realizing that can't really lead much of anywhere. But the fact is, there's nothing in that national security document that points towards spheres of influence. Consolidation in the Western Hemisphere, it doesn't mean we're going to concede any other sphere to any other power. It is the Wolfowitz doctrine warmed over. It's just neocon wine inside a mega bottle. Rhetorically, there's a lot of mega stuff in there, but when you look at it, it's the same old program of global domination. We're going to consolidate in the Western Hemisphere to project power more effectively abroad, and we're going to keep using the Europeans as a cutout because we want exactly what was said, a division of labor. And of course, and Pete Hegseth is saying exactly this. I think the Russians see through this.
Yeah, well, and also, gentlemen, the elephant in the room is that there's a $1 trillion military budget. Again, another still another year of $1 trillion being spent. What we get for it, I have no idea. I know a lot of people are immiserated around the world because of it. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Virginia, London, and in Rostov. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RTC. Next time, remember, Crosstalk rules.